Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Blessings to all. Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg. On our show tonight, it's sponsored by Starseed Gems, and they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Our guest tonight is Claire Bidwell-Smith, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what's up with you today?
Oh, not much. We just got loaded onto our website. I should mention to our listeners that there's a wonderful documentary called Calling Earth. The filmmaker is Dan Drayson, and the documentary is not actually totally complete, but it's 90% complete. It's wonderful in the condition that it's in. It's going to be finished by the end of October. And the filmmaker gave us permission to put it up on the site. So it's all about electronic voice phenomena, EVP and ITC, instrumental transcommunication. And if you were ever wondering what everybody's talking about with EVP, tune in. It gives a history of it. It gives tons of Class A examples. And it's hard to watch that and not come away with the feeling that EVP is indeed real, and it really is communication from another realm of existence. And people find that one on the science section.
Just go to the website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, and on the navigation bar on the left, towards the top, you'll see Afterlife Science. Click on that. That page has all the different avenues of proof that there is survival of consciousness, that there is an afterlife. And if you scroll about a third of the way down the page, you'll see the listing for electronic voice phenomena, and the video is right there.
You watched the film, right?
I watched the original one.
Right.
I haven't seen the new version that we just uploaded the other day.
What was your reaction? Do you recall when you saw
the original one? It was like, wow, somebody really researched this history and this validating information that it is real. I mean, I personally have tried to collect EVP so many different ways, and I never ever succeed in doing it. And yet I know people who just accidentally come home, there's a voice on their answering machine or on their cell phone, or there's an image that appears on their TV set, but I've never gotten it when I deliberately set out. But to watch a film like this that was so carefully researched and put together really hits home that this stuff is real, whether you could get it yourself or not.
Yeah.
It's real.
But in all fairness, I know that we've both tried, you know, to get it, but we really have not made any serious effort. I mean, sporadically here and there, but the people that are dedicated to it do it every day at the same appointed time on a regular basis.
And I think that's the key, and I think that's not just the key with electronic voice phenomena. That's the key in any kind of link you want to make permanent with the unseen world. So if you are a budding medium, or you just are experimenting with spirit circles, the key, as you say, is making that commitment. Every Sunday at 10 o'clock, I'm going to do this. And then Spirit says, well, if you're making that commitment, I'll make a commitment too, and I'll join in on all the fun.
Right.
And that seems to be the key.
Yeah. One of the things when you watch a film like that and you see just the abundance of all the evidence, it makes it look easy. You know,
exactly.
You want to just say, okay, let me get to this.
Let me get my tape recorder in.
Yeah, right. but it does take, as most people that in metaphysical practice know, I mean, it does take a lot of discipline and a lot of, as you mentioned.
Right, and just one thing pops into my mind. When we had our recent afterlife exploration retreat back in July, yeah. In Connecticut, we did make a very good effort on trying to collect EVP. We saged, we said prayers, we optimized everything. And yet, well, interestingly enough, as we all went to turn on our tape recorders in different locations, we all got the same response that we were unable to connect. So that, in and of itself, I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I guess somebody was playing a trick
with us.
No, maybe it wasn't at that point. You know, I was jotting down some notes for an article that I was writing, and I just wanted to bounce something off you quickly. I know, you know, we always have the expression when people are talking about lost loved ones, and people will say, well, you know, they live on in our hearts.
Or
they
live on in my
heart. Do you, what's your reaction when you hear that?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because somebody had said that in an email just yesterday or the day before, and it's like everything else. It just becomes rote. It's like you walk down the street, you bump into somebody that you haven't seen for a while. Oh, hi, how are you? Oh, I'm fine, how are you? She may not be fine. That's just the answer. So this is one of those same things. You're in my heart. We keep them in our heart. It's just an answer now. It's just something that you're supposed to say when someone's lost someone.
Yeah, and we're all guilty of that, because
right.
People don't know what to say. Or we say, you know, keep their memory alive and so forth.
And it's an easy escape in the conversation.
Yeah, but I, as I reflect upon it, I know, speaking personally, when people used to say, well, you know, she lives on in your heart, that, you know, I wouldn't say I took offense to that. But maybe I did, because I didn't want to know if they lived on metaphorically in my heart. I want to know if they lived on, period.
Period. Right.
You know, do they still exist or they don't, and thus
right.
The search.
But all of this talk about all of our organs and all of our beings and all of our cells and our consciousness and everything being connected, well, then technically, yes, they are in our heart and our liver and our every other part of our body.
Right. You know, and then, you know, with things, well, people also say, you know, their spirit, you know, lives on. But they may not be speaking in the terms in which we speak. When they say your spirit lives
right,
on,
right.
You know, we look at that and saying, well, yeah, your consciousness survived. So, yes,
right.
Your spirit lives on. But people, like you say, it's just a, you know,
it's just a response.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Speaking of this search, I mean, our guest tonight, we're going to bring on in a minute or two, is Claire Bidwell Smith, and we'll be talking with her personal journey and professional journey for Proof of Survival. So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by author Claire Bidwell Smith. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Claire Bidwell Smith. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, and they can be found on the web at www.starseedgems.com. Bob?
And Claire Bidwell Smith is a therapist specializing in grief and the author of two best-selling books of nonfiction, The Rules of Inheritance and After This, When Life is Over, Where Do We Go? Now, the first book, The Rules of Inheritance, is a coming-of-age memoir about grief, and it's currently being adapted for film. After This, the book we're going to be focusing on tonight, chronicles Claire's journey, both on a personal level and as a grief therapist, as she was searching for meaning and exploring various beliefs about the afterlife. Claire has a master's degree in clinical psychology. She teaches numerous workshops around the country. She's written for various publications, including the Huffington Post, and there's just an article in the New York Times. She currently works in private practice in Los Angeles, and her website, where you can learn a lot more than I'm telling you now, is her name, ClaireBidwellSmith.com. Claire is C-L-A-I-R-E, Bidwell Smith, just the way it sounds, .com. Welcome to the show, Claire. I was glad you could join us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess a good place to start, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about your book that's currently out, After This, When Life is Over, Where Do We Go? You lost both your parents and one of your best friends all within a few years of each other. And now, as you reflect upon it, was your interest in learning more about a possible afterlife an effort to help you in your own personal grief, or did you approach it more from a clinical perspective to help you counsel others in your professional work?
You know, by the time I actually began the work on this, I was pretty far out of my immediate grief process, and it was coming from a kind of more professional curiosity, but also out of a promise I had made to my dying best friend in my early 20s. When I was 21, one of my best friends got leukemia, and she died about a year after she was diagnosed. And during that time, she and I had a lot of conversations about death and the afterlife, and no one around us really wanted us to be talking about this. They wanted us to be positive and to think that Julie was going to live no matter what. And she had a lot of questions. And my mother had just died a few years before, so I was kind of in a place to talk with her about it more than anyone else. And on a whim, the summer before she died, I had picked up a book by psychic medium John Edward and was telling Julie about this book and about how the deceased communicated with him. And we were just fascinated by it. And so before she died, I promised her that I would go and see John Edward and find out if she was okay. And about 10 years later, I was living in Chicago. I was working as a grief counselor for hospice. And I realized I hadn't made good on my promise. And at this point, I was also becoming kind of very curious for my clients. I mean, I was, of course, curious for myself, but I didn't have a real desperate need in my personal life to kind of figure it out. I had some anxiety about death, though. I had become a mother, and that had brought up this kind of vulnerability that I felt in my life. And so I had become really curious about what would happen if I died and left my girl, my daughter, or what would happen, you know, the opposite. So it was kind of a whole amalgam of things that drove me to it, to this journey.
Yeah, I'm always wondering about the balance. And you mentioned, you know, you work professionally in hospice, and like most of your colleagues, I imagine you tried to help people accept and face the fact that a loved one is missing. So how do you balance your professional training with the personal exploration in terms of you might be showing that the deceased loved ones might not be missing at all?
Yeah, it's become interesting because I went into this whole journey pretty skeptical and not really believing in much of an afterlife and not really believing that we could connect with people on the other side. And now I feel differently. I do believe in an afterlife. I do believe we can connect with people on the other side. Yet I have to honor my clients' process and their belief systems, you know? So I think what I do more than anything with them is just kind of ask them questions and help them explore their own belief systems and help them kind of open up to different ideas. But I have to always meet them where they are initially, you know?
Yeah. Do people in session, do they, I mean, after all, they know about your book. I mean, do they ask you about mediums, like, while you're working with them?
They do. I often now make a lot of referrals to mediums, yeah, which is great. I think it's a really healthy way to look at your grief process, to look at your connection. If you can find a good medium and have a really good session with them, I think it can transform your grief process. Just in terms of feeling connected. I mean, I think that's one of the hardest parts about grief. You lose someone, like someone just enormous in your life, and their absence is so profoundly hard to grapple with. And so when you can find a sense of connection to them, you can have a much healthier a grief process and sadness.
I agree. I mean, you know, what could be more helpful to the grief process than the knowledge that your loved one still survives in some form? I mean, that's, to a lot of people, that's the only thing that can give them any hope.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When you, I remember reading in the book that it was sometime around the time of your friend's passing, your mother, your deceased mother, came to you in a vivid dream. Mm-hmm. So when she did that, did you perceive this as a true visit from your mom when you compared it to other dreams that you may have had in the past?
I do now. At the time, I wasn't ready to believe that. I knew it was a dream that was very different from any other kinds of dreams. I'd maybe had one or two other really intense dreams like that. So at the time I knew it was a remarkable dream, but I wasn't quite ready to believe it was actually a visit from my mom. When I look back on it now, from where I am now, I absolutely think it was.
And it did, as you reflect upon it, these visits have a different feel to them. Do they not? I mean, where people describe them as being more real or realer than real.
Yeah, they definitely do. It did not feel like a product of my own imagination. It felt like something much more much bigger than me, much more beyond my scope.
And I also remember about a year after the death of your mom, and that's during a time when you didn't necessarily believe in an afterlife, you decided to write to your mom, and you do so for a while. So is this something that you would recommend for others to do, you know, to write to their deceased loved ones?
I recommend it to every single client I have. Something that I have everyone do if they're up for it. It's such an emotional experience. I think there is a real sense of connection that can come from sitting down to do that. Yeah, I started on the 1 year anniversary of my mom's death. I missed her so much, and I've always been a writer, so that was kind of what came naturally to me. But I sat down and I wrote her a letter, and I told her all the things I had done in the last year, and I told her how much I missed her, and I expressed remorse for not having been with her when she died. And it was so much more cathartic than I'd anticipated, and it was hard too. I cried a lot. And I still, to this day, write her a letter every year on her death anniversary. And every year, it feels like something so much bigger than what it sounds like, you know?
Yeah.
It sounds like a kind of simple thing, but it's much bigger than that.
Yeah, and it's not the first time I've heard this. I know that, as you mentioned, a lot of people find it cathartic and helpful. So
mm-hmm.
it's great to hear that you recommend that. And incidentally, I know you write letters to your mom. You also, as people, when they pick up the book after this, when life is over, where do we go? You intermingle letters that you've written to your daughters. I don't, you know, I guess for them to read when they grow up, and it's they're very poignant and well written. I mean, it's you continue to do an excellent job.
You.
I enjoy reading those letters as much as the rest.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that happens when you lose someone you love, and this is what so many of my clients come to me with, is this anxiety that's related to grief. When you lose someone like a parent or a sibling or a spouse or a child, someone really significant in your life, it's there's nothing like that experience to just really remind you that life is so fragile and that any of us can go at any time and anything can kind of happen. And so for me, after my parents died, I had a lot of anxiety, and I constantly worried that I was going to get sick, that I was going to die. I just life felt very not up to me, and that was anxiety provoking, particularly not having any kind of belief system to fall back on. And so this is what I find a lot of my clients coming to me for, is just this profound, extreme anxiety following a loss. And that was part of what those letters were about for me. It was when I became a mom, my anxiety kind of went to a new place of worrying about this new connection I have with my daughters. And so I was writing those letters out of a place of trying to grapple with some of that and trying to safeguard some of it. But it was helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see it in your writing that... They're written from the heart, and you could tell that you've also suffered profound loss in your life, and so the writing is very deep. When you you mentioned that early on, you decided to see a few mediums and a few very good ones, and so as you now think back, if these initial sessions with the mediums proved to be non-evidential, I mean, how do you think this would have altered your subsequent search and personal beliefs?
That's such a good question. I think maybe I wouldn't have gone to see so many if the initial ones hadn't been so good. I probably would have. But what I know is that I really was searching for something. I was searching for some kind of framework with which to understand the afterlife. And so I think I would have kept searching in different realms, different religions, different spiritual angles, because that's what I was just looking for. I was realizing, again, this anxiety thing, that so much of our anxiety about where we go next has to do with what we believe about it and how we've connected to that idea. Mm. But I did have some great experiences with mediums. So I kind of went down the rabbit hole because it was just endlessly fascinating,
you
know?
Right. So what were what was the reaction of your friends when you told them that you were visiting mediums? Were they supportive or receptive? Did they tell you were nuts? Or
this was my favorite part of working on this book. I mean, I was at first I was kind of hesitant to talk about it, and then I started finding out that every time I would kind of come out of the closet about this, people would respond with such enthusiasm, but also this taboo. Like, I would get these like whispered, oh my God, I have to tell you about this time that I saw a medium too, or I have to tell you about this ghost story, or I have to tell you about this thing, but like, don't tell anybody, you know? So I just continued having all these wild secret conversations with people. And it was so much fun because people really wanted to talk about it. They still do. Now I just hear everybody's ghost stories and medium stories all the time.
Right.
But people are so excited to have someone to share it with.
Yeah. And they see you as presenting that safe environment. They know you're not going to judge them, so they'll open up to you. But
right.
what about with colleagues? I would imagine it wasn't quite the same when you talk to other people and the other professionals.
I still feel kind of careful about that, and like I don't talk about it too much. I had a piece come out in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, written from the perspective of a grief therapist, and I was advocating for psychic mediums. That I was saying that, regardless of whether or not they're quote unquote real, a really positive experience with one has an impact on the grief process in a really beneficial way. And you know what I was surprised by? I thought I was going to get a bunch of hate mail. And I got only a couple things of people, you know, skeptical. But what I got was a bunch of emails from other therapists around the country saying, thank you so much. I agree with you, and I'm too scared to talk about it. And so that was really cool to know that there's other people out there like me.
Absolutely. I mean, it is cool, and it just shows that we, you know, maybe we are breaking the ice, so to speak, and changing worldview about people. Both lay people and professionals are becoming more receptive to the possibilities. You actually, in part of your journey, which you write about in the book, you visited a psychotherapist who specialized in past life regression. So what were your thoughts going in? And, I mean, tell us a little bit about the experience.
Yeah, I did two past life regressions for the book, and I felt like I was really pushing my limits with that.
Yeah.
I moved out to California in my early 20s, and I started hearing about people doing past life regressions, and it really just seemed like the height of like woo-woo stuff you could do with like explore
right.
your past life. But I was also really curious, and both of my experiences were really interesting in different ways. You know, the second one I did was really startling. You know, it just, I still to this day do not know. I don't know where this came from, this vision I had. And what I felt like was that no matter if it was real or not, there was a lot of value in looking at it as though you would interpret a dream, or, you know, just a kind of a story you would write or something you would kind of look at in a symbolic way. There was so much there to dissect and to learn from about myself and my process and my own life. So I decided that this idea, like, I don't know if it matters if this stuff is quote unquote real. There's so much value to be found in it, period.
Right. And were you an easy subject? I mean, were you able to be hypnotized easily?
No. The first one I tried, I was so in my head about it. I couldn't stop overanalyzing everything that was happening.
Right.
I couldn't fully relax into it. And eventually there were some moments that did feel good and felt genuine where I was able to let go. But eventually my head just started chattering away too much. And I started lying to my hypnotherapist about, and I wrote about this in the book. I started making this up because I didn't want to disappoint him.
Right.
I didn't want to just sit up out of it and be like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And so I started lying. I was like, I'm in a hospital now at the end. And he was like, oh, it seems like you've come to the end of this lifetime. And I was like, I have, you know,
Go
ahead.
Because it's a natural reaction, and we kind of root for the underdog. We see that even in mediumship, and so, you know, we have a certification process that the mediums, you know, go through, and we train sitters. And the sitters, they have a natural inclination to make things fit, to try to help the medium when they're struggling. You know? And it's hard to train them not to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you were doing the same thing. You know, you kind of probably felt bad for the, it was another professional, and you wanted to make it easier for him, I guess.
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, but eventually like a year later, I did my next regression. And by that point, I had done so many weird things that I had really gotten used to just like not caring anymore and being able to turn off all the weird thoughts in my head. And then once I was able to do that and let go into these experiences a little bit more, the experience was so much profound.
Yeah. I get the sense, I don't know if you said it exactly in these words in the book, but that you viewed life and death as part of a divine plan. Was that something, is that the way you think of life and death? I mean, do you think it's planned? And I always wonder, because I think it makes the grieving process easier if we sort of believe it's out of our hands, you know?
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. Sometimes I have trouble fully like buying into that story,
yeah.
But I really, really do like the idea. And because you're right, it does make the grieving process a lot better. You know, I had an astrologer tell me that this was like I contracted into this. You know, to lose both of my parents and to go on this journey of writing about it all. And like that makes it sound more palatable, right?
Right.
But yeah, I like. Yeah, I'm not sure if again. I'm pretty skeptical and grounded, but I think that in some ways I think that's helpful because my goal is to really help other people who are also skeptical feel like they can explore this and not necessarily have to know the answer.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a debate forever, about free will versus destiny, you know, you know, I guess a lot of people believe that there is some sort of a framework that's worked out somewhere, but free will, you know, can interrupt that, you know, in different ways. But
I kind of agree with that. Like, I think there's probably an overall theme of life, like we're here to do something, you know, and fulfill some kind of end goal, and how we get there though is kind of up to us. And the path we take in order to achieve that is up to us. And I think that some of us can, like, I think we can also just completely ignore it and spend our lives kind of asleep or, you know, in unhealthy patterns. But I think the signs are kind of there if we want to follow them to
right
what our end goal is supposed to be. I feel that a lot.
You've worked as you mentioned in hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously there's a lot of people in hospice that are fearful of what awaits. Why do you think that as a general rule most administrators in hospice frown upon discussions of the afterlife?
I don't know. That hasn't entirely been my experience. I felt like the people that I worked with in hospice were pretty open to it, at least in my experience of it.
Yeah.
I loved my time in hospice. And, you know, I felt like when I was working in hospice, I was 31 and my first daughter was being born. And I was living in, as I said, the Midwest. And I had five baby showers because people in the Midwest get so excited about baby showers and babies. And I had like two office baby showers and a friend one, and like whatever. It went on and on. And at the same time, so I was like all this prep for my daughter, and I had a midwife and a doula, and I was going to birthing classes, and I was reading all these books. At the same time, I was spending my days at work driving around in these suburbs to people's homes where someone was dying. And I was really struck by the difference and how there was so little reverence and attention paid to the end of life. There was so little ritual. There was so little ceremony. There was so little kind of celebration or intention that there was to bringing someone into this world.
Mm.
Letting someone go out of it, not the same thing, you know? And that I was just really struck by it. And I would like to see that begin to change. And I think it is little by little.
I think it is too. And that was very well said. We're talking with Claire Bidwell Smith. The book is After This, When Life is Over, Where Do We Go? Claire's website is Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E, BidwellSmith.com. We're going to go to a break. There's lots more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Wind Bridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a WindBridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is Claire Bidwell Smith. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, and they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Our holidays past raffle is up on the website now, waiting for your name to be entered. So let me quickly explain how the raffle works and why you need to enter now, even though the drawing is not until December 23rd. The five winners, each receiving a one-hour medium reading with either Tracy Lee Nash, Doc Neil Zapowski, Nancy Marlowe, Dustin Livers, or Kathy Towell, are chosen from a computer program that selects five numbers randomly from the pool of consecutive numbers that are assigned to each entry. So enter often, and have lots of different numbers. Our September webinar, Pop Culture Consciousness, will be presented by Professor Paranormal Lloyd Auerbach, current president of Forever Family Foundation, and you can find the registration link to this September 23rd webinar on our events page, along with Kim Russo's event for us on October 24th, as she takes time off from her busy filming schedule of her two shows, The Haunting of and Psychic Intervention. The evening will also include medium Joe Peretta. Get your seats online. This will be at the Long Island University CW Post campus in Brookville, New York. Our listeners who live in Florida or who plan to be there on November 13th, remember to sign up for Visitations and Validations, an evening of spirit communication, with Joanne Gerber at the Hampton Inn and Suites, Miami Airport South at 7 p.m. And December is not far away. We have two annual holidays past events scheduled, Joanne Gerber in Natick, Massachusetts, and Joe Shield joins Janet Nohavik as they team up in Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. Both events are on December 12th. And finally, please, please, please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. And speaking of donations, remember when you shop on Amazon to please use the Amazon link from our website to go do your Amazon shopping. It will not cost you any more money, and everything that goes into your shopping cart will generate a donation to Forever Family Foundation from Amazon. If you don't shop on Amazon, give iGive.com a try. Name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. And again, when you shop on the Internet, a donation is made to Forever Family Foundation. And if you are a business interested in advertising on this show, contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org, or you could call the office at 631-425-7707. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Claire Bidwell-Smith. The book is After This, When Life is Over, Where Do We Go? And Claire, as part of your exploration, you spoke with several, you know, credentialed scientists, and you learned about research that showed that the mind could act independently of the brain. When you learned about all this credible evidence, did you find that deepen your belief in life after death when it came from the scientist as opposed to personal experience?
It was really helpful to talk with people like that. And that was kind of what gave me something to hold on to. I mean, Spirituality is so elusive, right? You know, all these things we're talking about, mediums and past lives and all this stuff, it's really hard to see it, to feel it, to hold on to it, to really have faith in it. I feel like that's something you have to keep practicing and coming back to. And what I wanted was like proof and facts and things to really hold on to. So that was helpful. I had actually met Dr. Julie Beischel at one of your conferences. And I went on, I loved her presentation. I just thought she was fascinating because she was actually studying, you know, the science behind mediumship. And so I read her books and interviewed her. And that was really, you know, just again, that it gave me something to kind of grasp in a way that I was looking for.
Yeah. And then, so, you know, some people don't, you know, they have this inner knowledge and they don't really need the confirmation from science. But others, like myself and many other people, really sought that confirmation. So that I'm not imagining, you know, these things. So I think the
confirmation
too is very potent. And you made me chuckle a little bit at near the end of the book where you were going on about all these things that you would like to do, you know. You listed about 10 things, which were all, you know, great things. But then you came to the realization that you could spend a lifetime searching for answers. I mean, so do you get the feeling that somehow the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know?
Absolutely. And I think I probably will spend my lifetime in this realm and on this path. I mean, I've read so much about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and like a similar thing happened to her. You know, she started talking to dying people, started on the medicine side of it, looking into all of that. And once you kind of open that door, death just blooms into a bigger and bigger concept that is seemingly endless. You know, by the end of her life, she was having seances and she was having induced near-death experiences and had become very spiritual. It's kind of the only route, you know, left at this point when you really start to look at death in such a big way.
Yeah. I mean, your writing is definitely seems as if, you know, you have great inspiration. And I know that you were told that your mother in spirit, you know, does continue to inspire you, but mm-hmm. also assist you in your writing. So when you're sitting down in your writing, do you sometimes think that some of the thoughts are coming from Mom?
I sometimes think they're coming from, like, maybe a more collective unconscious, mm-hmm. and just something I started during the course of the book. I became very interested in kind of ritual and ceremony, and I started kind of an altar table. And while I was writing this book, I had a ritual where before I wrote almost every day, but I would start off before my writing sessions by lighting candles and just kind of opening myself up and asking for, you know, guidance that this book be something that's helpful to other people and whatever that looks like. And so sometimes when I was working, I kind of just felt like whatever was flowing through me was doing that. Yeah. And it felt good. It's yeah. something I still do.
And as readers will find out, I mean, some of these situations that you were in were kind of emotionally draining. I mean, you were, you know, sensory yeah. deprivation, and you were really out there, you know, stripping down to the raw, you know, the raw emotional level. So you really not only wrote about it, but you wrote from experience. One thing that I think it's important to mention, you have these wonderful discussions with your children, and concerning what happens, you know, after death. And a lot of people that you talk to, they'll say, "Oh no, this is not something that we should be discussed with children." I mean, what are your thoughts on that? How do parents approach the subject of life after death with their kids?
Yeah, I think the contrary. I think we should talk to our kids about death, and we should talk to them about it very openly and from the beginning. Death is a fact of life. It's going to happen to all of us, and they are going to face it and have it happen in their lives at some point. And I think that the more we can open up the discussion about it, the more we can normalize it. And so when it does happen, it's not this giant, shocking, traumatic thing that it can be so often now when we don't talk about it. And I also just found it really refreshing. Most of the conversations I had were with my daughter, who was at the time 4 and 5 years old. And I just, I really appreciated how simple it was for her. You know, as adults, we make it so complicated and nuanced and dramatic, and we put all these layers on top of death and grief. And she would just take it, you know, these conversations in a very face value kind of way, in a very matter of fact kind of way. And her questions were very simple and very refreshing. And then also, like, her sense of connection to my parents. She's very aware that my parents are gone. And as I was starting to connect with them on a more spiritual level, I kind of was open about that in front of my daughters. And so now my both of them, they talk to my parents all the time. And it feels really, really amazing. We were in the car just the other day, and we were driving past where my father used to live at the end of his life. And I just kind of started talking about him, and I started telling stories about him. And I could just feel it. Like, right before my daughter said this, I just felt it. I was telling all these stories, and my daughter was so fascinated and asking more and more questions. And suddenly she finally just said, "Mom, I think he can hear us right now. I think he's so happy that we're talking about him. He's so happy that we're talking about him." And I had had the exact same thought and the same feeling right before she said it. And I loved that she thinks that. She's 6, you know? And then she was like, "Hi, Grandpa, we're talking about you. We love you." And that's beautiful, right? So when she does really encounter death for the first time, she loses a friend or a family member, I really hope that this retains for her and she does feel like she has this sense of connection.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful, and they're going to be better prepared for you know, whatever life throws at them. You know, mm-hmm. It seems to be healthy, and we create so much anxiety and trauma by avoiding
right.
the suspect. You know,
absolutely.
Sense at all. What's also interesting, I don't know, well, you described this sense of presence that sometimes things don't hit you over the head, but you get this sense of presence. Your daughter's felt it, or your daughter felt it, and you felt it, and it's just this kind of inner knowing without any tangible evidence other than you knowing, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
Really
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Also, sometimes children, we've heard so many accounts where children describe seeing deceased relatives that they never knew, you know, when the relatives were alive. You
I know.
Know.
I love those stories.
I know. Because what could be more evidential? Because as you mentioned, I mean, children are so innocent. They're not. They're
right.
not
so. I know. Those are some of the most fascinating stories to me. And kids who have described having had a past life and, like, literally been someone else. And it'll have been, like, someone in another country in the 40s, you know, but they'll describe them to the T. And it's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, the researchers, like, you know, like Jim Tucker and Ian Stevenson,
mm-hmm.
the University of Virginia, I mean, they do these very thorough investigations, like detectives, you know, when they come up with these stories, and they check, you know, dental records and medical records and death certificates and newspapers and go to libraries and deeds and things, and the evidence sometimes is just irrefutable. It really makes
yeah.
you think when you have thousands of cases of it.
Claire,
do you think that sometimes we, when we go on the subject of the afterlife, that a lot of people get caught up in religious dogma or other, you know, cultural influences? When you talk about a belief in life after death, there's sort of this this wall that goes up. I mean, do you find that even in your patients when the subject?
Absolutely, I think that's one of the hardest ones. Those doctrines are so strong, and when they come on in childhood, when you're raised in a particular religion or kind of cultural belief system from when you are very little, it's really hard to shake them. And so one of the things I ask my clients a lot, you know, I'll ask them all about their belief system, and then I'll ask them, well, my favorite question when I was working on the book, and I kept asking everyone, what do you think happens when you die? I would just ask everyone I knew that question. Finally, one of my friends turned to me and he said, who cares? What do you want to happen when you die? And I thought that was such an interesting question, and it took me a long time to answer it. But it's now something I ask my clients, and I say, does this idea that you have about what you want to happen, what you most hope will happen, does it line up with your religious beliefs? Does it line up with the things you feel you were taught, or the things that you kind of, you know, the parameters and the walls that restrict your belief system now? And if it doesn't, you know, is it worth exploring that? Is it worth looking into changing that or adopting a different kind of belief system that feels better?
Right. Well, I know we're reaching the end of our time here, but I did want to mention to you, Claire, that, you know, Einstein, much like yourself, wrote letters to his daughter with the notion or the expressed desire that they don't read it for decades until they were better able to, and they're starting to come out now. And in the letter that I read, he expressed the notion that love was the dominant force in the universe, and that was pretty interesting. I saw that in your writing, and when Einstein said it, but boy, you have some confirmation that you're on the right track.
I'm flattered to be compared to Einstein. Thank you.
We're talking to Claire. We haven't talked with Claire Smith. The book, After This, When Life is Over, Where Do We Go? Claire's an excellent writer, recommended highly. There's a link to the book on the Forever Family Foundation website. Claire, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And
thank
I hope
you.
We
this was so fun.
All right. Take care and have a good evening.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of the recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. As we visualize the healing light upon Eddie Roll, Tom Donahue, Tim Donahue, Andrea, Richard Bryan, Karen Henry Stark, Johnny Jackson, Andy O'Brien, Stanley Mullen, Glenna Irwin, Lynn Austin, Michael Tim, Patty Potter, Eileen LaFada, Wendy Lippo, Deb Berry, Philip McPhee, Denise, Joanne Gerber, Betty Kovach, Erica, Tracy Lee Nash, Jean Lash, Vicki Steffi, Rita Springer, David Haith, Ann Hutchinson, Julie Beischel, Marian Pierzga, Rachel Scandarian, Kimberly Saavedra, Matt Mello, David Mello, Donna Mello, Judy Pernick, Johnny Boo, Allah, Pat Drance, and Donald Peterson. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away,
and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.